Inside Security Podcast with Martin and Steve Yvette and Little Joe. News Yankee Steve giving weekly updates. Armor guy managing the microphones. Joseph's there and sparkles while the vet's in the airport. Andy Googles Microsoft on his iPhone. A family-friendly bucket full of southern goodness. What will they be ranting about this week?
It's episode 196 of the Southern Fried Security Podcast. My name is Martin Fisher. So glad you could join us. And hopefully if you're listening to this relatively soon after we posted, you've picked up on your sleep debt from last week. And there's so much to talk about. But before we go there, let's introduce the folks here on the line with me all the way from the great state of Indiana, our obligatory news Yankee, Steve Reagan. How are you, sir?
I'm good. How are you?
Almost paid up my sleep debt. Almost paid up. And joining us as well, he sparkles like the morning dew. Joseph Sokoli, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing great.
You know, we're recording this in May 2017, and you know, hey, got anything interesting happen over the last week or so in InfoSec?
Not that I can think of. I mean, it's been pretty quiet.
Hey, what about that ransomware thing?
Yeah, there was that. It's a small thing. It's a small thing. I don't even know if it's really worth talking about.
I think it might be for those people who listen to us who may have been under a rock or you know hiding somewhere in North Korea. Let's talk. Yeah, you see what I did there. So let's talk about WannaCry real quick, Steve. Just the high level, and then. What we want to talk about today is the stuff that you could have and should have learned if you were doing IR in response to WannaCry. So give us the background, Steve.
All right. So it's port 445. Do you know where your SMB is? If you don't, then you probably got a nasty surprise last week. Anywhere between, depending on the data you're tracking, at least 45,000, but upwards of 200,000. And even then, the number might still be larger. Systems were compromised. Now, what happened was there was some ransomware, WannaCry, that wanted to spread around and, you know, get up to no good. So the long and short of it is the reason why this was so impactful was because a whole bunch of Windows 7 computers were not patched properly. And on top of that, people were exposing SMB to the public. And as such, this ransomware was able to worm its way through thousands and thousands and thousands of computers. How did it do that? It leveraged leaked NSA code that took advantage of a vulnerability in SMB. Ta-da! Instant wormable ransomware. Your weekend and the following 7 days are now ruined. Thank you. Do not pass go. Don't collect $200.
So I will give you a 10 out of 10 on accuracy and succinctness for that.
Thank you.
Yeah, if you can't tell, people are getting a little punchy talking about this one, that's for sure.
It's just driving everybody nuts, dude. It's all anybody's talking about. I mean, I feel for everybody in Russia, though. I know it's a big topic, but seriously, I was like, that country got smashed by this. I mean, it was just,
China.
Yeah. Well, Russia, Ukraine, India, and Taiwan were like the biggest hit, but we got really lucky. Didn't we? Because of one researcher who was paying attention.
Yeah,
and now paying a price for being a good guy. But that's a topic for another show.
And one of the areas that was particularly heavily hit by WannaCry, the ransomware, was the medical device sector or hospitals, things along those lines. And I've seen a lot of misinformation or half understanding or questions around why that particular area was hit so heavily by WannaCry. I want to refer people back to our episode earlier this year, episode 189, Medical Device Security, where we talked a lot about the challenges that medical devices face, the challenges that hospitals face, and some of the reasonings, some of the underlying causes for why these devices were hit as heavily as they were.
Another thing I want to call out is Risky Business, the security and InfoSec podcast by Pat Gray out of Australia. If you really want to understand the challenges that healthcare has, in the first part of that podcast, he talks specifically about healthcare IT, healthcare IT security. And, you know, as I talked about on Twitter, it's probably one of the best explanations by a non-healthcare person as to the sort of Sophie's choice that we face sometimes. So if you're actually interested in hearing it from maybe another perspective, definitely go take a listen to that episode.
And we'll make sure I find that link and get it in the show notes as well. But so now that we've finally started to come down off of the edge of the cliff that everybody seemed to be standing on for WannaCry, Martin, you kind of wrote up a bit of an outline, and that'll also be in the show notes, around kind of the lessons you could or should have learned dealing with WannaCry, dealing with this high visibility incident. It was a fairly complex incident, and then it was also a rather nasty incident. And so you've kind of written up three steps or three pieces of your outline: the lead up, when the crisis arrives, and the aftermath. And so I wanted to kind of go ahead and step through that. Steve will be adding some color commentary as we go through, but I guess, why don't, Martin, you start us off with the lead up to WannaCry? Like, what should we have been learning here? What can we learn from this incident?
So I think one of the big things is that threat intelligence is a thing, and it's fun. I mean, to point fingers and laugh at some of the phraseology that comes out of RSA. So put the marketing phraseology aside. Threat intelligence is a thing. Knowing what's going on in the world, both outside and inside of your public and private IP space network demarcation, because there's no such thing as a perimeter anymore. Understanding what's going on both sides of that is really important. And in really understanding when things are happening outside in on the internet, being able to understand what that means for you, and that doing that level of threat intelligence and being able to do that analysis it's hard. There's a lot of data. Some of it you can trust, some of it you can't. A lot of us don't have really good views into all the stuff that's on our network. Shadow IT can bring, you know, their stuff in that you may not know about. Third parties can bring stuff in and put it on your network that you don't know about. And the problem is on something like this, where it's wormable. It could be something you didn't know about that gets owned, and all of a sudden a whole bunch of things you do know about are suddenly owned. And the thing is that the challenge, and this is where you get back toward the marketing of threat intelligence, most of the feeds are
garbage. Just going to say it. They're garbage.
And because what there are is they're sending you bits of data, and there's not really systems out there right now that can help you assess the data points you're getting and then apply it to your system. So I know that for me, and probably a lot of people like me, the biggest threat intelligence feed I had was Twitter and a handful of blogs and websites that I kept constantly refreshing, almost like I was trying to get ShmooCon tickets, trying to get more information Friday night, Saturday, and Sunday. And meanwhile, I'm already coming up with my plan for what we're going to do on Monday. Now, thank goodness that by the time the malware rolled into our time zones, because it was kind of following the sun like a lot of wormable stuff does, a lot of it had already been, the kill switches had been hit, and we had bought some time. But you have to understand in the lead up what you're facing, because without that information, you're going to drive into this blind, and you won't know what to do when you finally get into the office, roll up your sleeves and gather the team and go, you know, ladies and gentlemen, we have a whole lot of work to do in front of us, and here's the plan. And so, you know, that's when everything hits the fan.
So looking back, there are a couple of threat intelligence pieces that stand out to me. Every threat intelligence vendor had these two. There's no special snowflake or, you know, just one standout. They all had this, and that is Eternal Blue, the name of the NSA exploit that was used to propagate WannaCry. And then, of course, you know, the Microsoft patches. Now, the SMB fix, the patch that addresses the vulnerability in SMB, was MS-1710. And everybody knew about this, okay? And everybody knew about Eternal Blue. But here's the problem. When these intelligence feeds come to you and they tell you about Eternal Blue and they tell you about MS, you know, 1710, they don't have context. They're not saying how this applies to your network or what this means to you.
Exactly.
And internally, if you don't know what your systems are aware, for example, how many systems need patched because they expose SMB? Are we even using SMB? How do we find out? If you can't answer those questions, you were a sitting duck when this attack launched. That's the honest truth of it. It's the basics that actually saved a lot of companies and a fast-thinking researcher. I shudder to think what would happen if that original wave did not have a kill switch. If it didn't have a kill switch, we would probably wouldn't be having this podcast because Martin would still be at work.
Probably.
You know, 30 days now, he's still at work. We haven't seen or heard from him. We know he's alive. We're sending sandwiches, but we haven't seen him yet.
And it's funny, but it's funny because it's true. We got incredibly lucky, and for whatever reasons, we got incredibly lucky.
Now, that said, it was definitely still a bit of a crisis. I know on, you know, my company's end, we're still dealing with it. I know, Martin, on your end, there's still some bits and pieces here and there. So when the crisis arrived, you know, can you kind of walk us through, you know, either your plan as it was executed or your plan as you would have wished it had been executed?
Okay, so the biggest thing, and this goes for any time you're in an IR and you're a security leader, you have to stay calm, right? You cannot scare the children. Someone has to be the responsible adult who manages to still have a smile on their face and not get grumpy and, you know, provide direction. And it's someone that, you know, people can look at and go, well, they're not freaking out, so I guess this isn't as bad as some of the media wants us to make it look to be. And the other thing is when you're leading incident response, you have to absolutely prioritize your responses. And that was one of the things that kind of drove me crazy with some of the stuff I was reading on the internet, is you were reading all these contradictory things that you must do first. And again, sort of related to the threat intelligence conversation we just had, it's going to depend. I mean, one of the very first things you need to do is realize you have a finite amount of human resources that you can throw at the problem. And you also have a finite amount of time, which means you can never do all the things that all the people are telling you you should do. So one of the things that we did at the hospital, we said, okay, came up with three potential remediations for devices, and we prioritized the order in which we would want them to be deployed, depending on what that asset could tolerate. Medical devices, you just can't load AV on them, and you just can't load MS-17010. So maybe you can turn off SMB version 1. Maybe there's other things you can do. And you've got to have those list of immediate actions that you're going to do, and then make sure the people out there actually doing the work understand it. The other big thing is you have to know what your tools can do, and you got to be ready to use all of them. And we sort of talked about this on Andy talked about a lot on episode 192, Security Waste. We have a metric boatload of tools in our environment that can do lots of interesting things. You need to be able to leverage every tool in your toolkit to provide any sort of remediation or anything that can buy you time to actually get remediations done, either from a detective control, a preventative control, anything. You've got to figure out what you have, because you're not going to be able to call a security vendor and promise them a PO number to get their blinky box on your network when this is happening. You know, there's a former Secretary of Defense, you go to war with the army you've got, and you go into incident response with the security program that you've got. And the other thing that you need to do is you really need to know what area you're going to focus on first. And your business continuity program, your BCP program, that will inform what the most important stuff is. The stuff that you would recover first in a business continuity DR situation is probably the stuff you want to focus on first. And of course, this is assuming that you have a business continuity program, because we We all should. And if we don't, you really want to think about it. BCPDR programs aren't just checkbox stuff. They can inform how you do IR. And if you do BCP right, that will help feed the information you will have about your systems and about your network that you can then apply the threat intelligence information to. There's this eternal circle that's happening.
So to keep it so basic, a good BCP is the difference between having a rough day at the office and having a rough month at the office and an ulcer, and you might lose your job.
Right.
It's a horrible circle that once it starts spiraling out of control, it's nothing.
And it can spiral very, very fast. You have to pay constant attention to it. And you have to plan the work and then work the plan. And you need to not get distracted. That said, there are going to be times when things happen that you didn't want to have happen. And you may get a portion of your network that gets impacted. And this is something that's really hard for some security professionals to do because, you know, the bad guy has impacted some of my machines and our honor, you know, seems to be at stake here. And sort of what I call this is you have to be willing to cut off an arm to save the body. There are times you may have to disconnect the links to portions of your network that are infected to save everybody else. Now, you as the security leader or you as a, you know, someone on the IR team may not have that authority, but you have to be willing to make that recommendation to the person in authority to say, you know, we've lost the, you know, that segment of the network and we need to cut them off so we can save everybody else, and then we'll go back into that one and fix it. Because the big thing is, and you know, I don't want to go off on an anti-vaxxer rant, but herd immunity is a thing. Yeah, if you have a self-propagating worm that gets into your network and 90% of your devices are vulnerable, cancel Christmas. It's over. It's done. There's nothing you can do about this. The contagion will spread so far, so fast, you're going to be walking around reimaging machines or dropping new machines on every desk. But if only 1 or 2% of your machines are vulnerable to it, that's manageable. You can find those point infections that can't spread because of the herd immunity, and you can snuff them out. It's when that single infection turns into a contagion, which becomes a conflagration, that you've completely lost. And that's the whole point of an IR situation when you're dealing with wormable malware, is you've got to stop it where it starts. There's so many different analogies. You can compare it to epidemiology. You can relate it to the way the Forest Service fights forest fires. You know, in my background, it's the way a cavalry unit worries about when they're doing screening. You have to be willing to cut your losses sometimes, but you have to remember that you prevent small things from becoming big things, and that's how you win.
There is one thing that you were talking about, you know, cutting off the arm to save the body. There's a story last week. I talked to an engineer somewhere in the United States who had this problem. And fortunately for them, they only had 6 systems that were impacted, but these were critical systems. And his only recourse was to pull the plug. And his response was, it's easier to image these systems than to try and image an entire network.
Yep.
And I was just like, actually really impressed by that, because I mean, these are critical systems, and he didn't hesitate. He pulled that plug. They were done. And there was nothing that could be done about them except, you know, attempt to restore from backups. Hopefully they work. His words, not mine. Hopefully they work. Otherwise, it's easier to reimage these 6 machines and start from scratch than it would be to do the other 4,000. I'm not even going to try.
Right.
And his WannaCry experience was done in about 12 hours. That's it, from start to finish.
Mm-hmm.
But if he'd have had that entire network, oh man, he'd have been there. He'd still be there.
Right.
And going back, here's another funny tidbit. This is an MSSP that may or may not be well known to everybody. Going back, you know, prioritize your responses. What are the first things you should be doing, right? Well, this MSSP started sending directives to companies who weren't even affected by this. They had no vulnerabilities. And here are companies trying to scramble and figure out what's going on and how are they impacted and everything like this. And they were never in the line of fire to begin with. But their security team scared the children.
Yeah, that's the stuff that you don't want to do. And there's about four things we talk about that you just don't do. One is don't scare the kids. People, especially for us, what was really interesting with WannaCry, more than almost anything else like this that I can really remember, this got into the mainstream media. I mean, you had the Wall Street Journal and Bloomberg, stuff that executives read, carrying on umpty-ump column inches talking about this thing. And it really freaked executives out. And what you have to do as the security leaders, you need to not scare the people who are on the IR team, but you also need to not scare the executives. Now you want to be very candid. You want to be very forthright in what your capabilities are and what the outlooks are, but you need to choose your words carefully. And that's going to vary from company to company. Some words in certain corporate cultures would be okay to use, where in other cultures, using that exact same language would cause everyone to think that the Armageddon had arrived. So just use your words carefully. The other thing is you can't waffle in decision making. When I was at the Armor Officer Basic course, we had a Marine captain who was our tactics team chief. And one of his things that he would walk up to a lieutenant who had been, playing the role of a platoon leader who had maybe done some decision waffling, is he would very loudly, so that everyone could hear it, recite the fact that there are good decisions and bad decisions and no decisions, and the worst by far is no decision. Sitting and waffling or changing your mind wastes resources, wastes your political capital with the people on the IR team, because they're going to start thinking you have no idea what you're doing, and that whatever they're doing is not being helpful and not adding value, which means they're not going to work as hard. And your executives are going to start questioning your competence to continue leading that organization. So don't waffle. Make a decision, make a reasonable decision, and move on it. The other big thing, and this is one that I think I'll be honest, this is something that I have to make sure I don't do, because just part of my personality is to, I'm a dad, and this is what dads do. Don't focus on what you can't do. When you're in an IR, this is not the time to point out to the CFO that if you'd only had that investment from the capital budget last year, we wouldn't have this problem. Or to point out to the folks over in IT ops, I've been telling you for 8 months that your patching program sucks. Just don't do that. You are where you are. You have what you have. Go do your job. Now, when it's all said and done, there's going to be opportunities to talk about it. But in the moment of the crisis, in the moment of the incident response, don't do that. I can't stress enough to not do that. It's unprofessional. It is the antithesis of good leadership. And you will have likely destroyed almost any opportunity you have in the aftermath to help improve things. Because if you've embarrassed someone or shown them up, they're going to work very hard in the aftermath to make sure that there's no way you can pin this on them, which is going to make making sure this never happens again much more difficult, if not impossible, to do.
And to the point, like early on when this all started to spread around, the vendors jumped on this. Like how I would describe it is not really appropriate, but they jumped all over this. And the fact of the matter is, no blinky box in the world is going to save you from the fact that you were, exposing your computers, vulnerable computers, to the public.
Right.
And that's where this started. And then it spreads internally. So it's a thing that there's no vendor in the world that really could have seen this coming. It's just not possible. And yet there they go.
So the last thing you want to make sure you don't do is you don't want to overpromise. You don't want to overpromise to the people working on IR that, hey, you know, this is great. We'll be done in 2 hours. You also don't want to overpromise to your peers or to your leadership that you can fix this in X hours. Or on the flip side, you don't want to promise them that the world is going to come to an end in 12 hours. You want to be reasonable. You want to be candid. You want to be proactive. So
here's what we're doing. Here's how we're doing it. We'll let you know.
So the last thing is the aftermath. And I think the first step of the aftermath, make sure you're actually in the aftermath and still not in a crisis. I've seen people who've tried to end IRs way too early. The guys over in manufacturing, they'll wrap that up in about 3 hours. So we're going to go ahead and break down the bridge. Oh, God, please don't do that. Make sure you're done. And the first thing, one of the very first things you want to do is you want to gather the key people on your team. And you want to do a hot wash, which is basically, I like doing this with Post-it notes, is you just, everyone writes down things we did well, things we didn't do, things that were missed, things we have to follow up on. You just create Post-it notes. And then you let everyone go home, get some sleep, and then come back. And then you want to do a full, in the Army, we call them after-action reviews. Some places call them post-mortems. And really go through and be aggressively examine what you did. Now, you don't want to be a martyr, right? Point out the things that your team did well, but also point out the areas that you could have improved on, or point out what other teams did that worked out really well. For example, me at the hospital, our group that we call Microsystems, it's the desktop guys, were fantastic during this. I mean, just mind-bogglingly ingenious in what they did. And they get a lot of credit for the fact that this was, from a clinician perspective, a more or less non-event. And we couldn't have done this without them. And you want to make sure you call that out. And when you do that, it's not just so that you can pat people on the back or show up, you know, that other person who wasn't doing their job. You want to document your lessons learned, and you want to do it in a very neutral Joe Friday method, and you want to distribute them. You want to make sure that the right people throughout your organization can see what happened and the role they played and where they could have done better. Or, like in the case of my folks, the ones that just really knocked it out of the park, you know. I want to make sure that my leadership knows that this other group did a fantastic job and made things so much better. And then also the big thing is you want to follow up, follow up, follow up. You need to make sure that all the little things that, you know, T's are crossed, I's are dotted, all the remediations are documented, especially when you're dealing with shadow IT or vendor-provided systems, that they actually kept their promise and they did the things they were supposed to do, and then you're done.
I'm going to add one more point to your aftermath.
Uh-huh.
Once you're done with all this, go back to your BCP and adjust it accordingly so that when this happens again, you have new, updated information on what to do, what worked, and what didn't.
Absolutely. Wow, that was a very fast episode we just went through.
Worst part is we could sit here and talk about this much, much longer.
Oh, absolutely, I could, but...
And we're also... We're not going to quiz you, Martin, on which bits are learning from experience versus learning from mistakes. We'll let you slide on this one.
So what's the phrase?
Ask me no questions.
Right. Good judgment comes from experience, and you gain experience from bad judgment. Right. And I think for a lot of folks, you can learn a lot from these IR items. You can learn a little bit from what you did well and reinforce that, but you learn the most from things that you didn't do well, so that you change it for next time. And that's how you iteratively get better, and that's how you win, because it's all about hashtag winning, right?
Absolutely.
So with that, guys, I think we have reached the end of our time. So on behalf of the missing Andy Willingham, who his schedule seems to be getting better, so we're hopefully he'll be joining us again shortly, and the missing Yvette Johnson, who... he's dealing with a sick daughter, and get better, Reagan. Guys, it's been great talking to you, and everybody, we'll be back soon with another episode of the podcast.
Night, everybody.
Good night.